It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new CDC report sheds light on Wisconsin's binge drinking problem. We'll look at the impact of widespread overconsumption of alcohol and possible solutions. First, Facebook and a London-based data analytics firm are at the center of controversy over the alleged misuse of millions of users' personal data. This all goes back to a seemingly innocuous Facebook app in 2014 that was developed by a professor at the University of Cambridge. People used it to learn their personality type and in the process gave up data about themselves and their Facebook friends. The researchers shared that data with the political firm Cambridge Analytica, according to a former employee named Christopher Wiley. He says 270,000 people used that quiz app, so the data of some 50 million users, mainly in the U.S., was taken without their consent. Yesterday, Wiley said on NBC's Today Show that Cambridge Analytica used that data to psychologically profile people and deliver pro-Donald Trump material to them.
I think it's really important for Americans to know what this company has been doing with their data. And it's really important, I think, to find out, was this data used to help elect Donald Trump?
Cambridge Analytica was hired by the Trump campaign. According to a report today from CBS News, the campaign switched from the company's data to Republican National Committee data in the last months before the election. As for Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, both firms deny any wrongdoing. This afternoon, Cambridge Analytica's board suspended its CEO, Alexander Nix. Steve Knoll joins us now to sort out this complicated story. He's a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's a complicated story. It's getting a lot of buzz. Is this, first of all, a big deal?
It is, but anyone that's been kind of studying social media and especially how it can be used as a marketing tool, it's not really a surprise. This is how digital marketing works. You mine information of users, and then you match up appropriate products to those people. The big thing is because it's attached to a political campaign, and of course, all the controversy following the president, that has resulted in the story really being blown to high proportions.
So let's break it down a little bit. All this user data ended up with this company, Cambridge Analytica, no relation to the University of Cambridge.
Correct.
And against, it looks like, Facebook's terms of service. How did it get there? What did they get?
Well, originally it was explored basically as a research, you know, kind of like a professor running a study on collecting data. And then it was then taken and then used for marketing efforts. That's what violated Facebook's terms. Facebook was aware that the data was being collected, but when it was then basically sold off, that was a violation. And Facebook has suspended this company from running campaigns or collecting data on it, but, you know, the cows have already left that barn. But it's no different than many other companies that are out there trying to mine as much information from Facebook and any other social media platform either.
Right. If I were running for office, I could go to Facebook, mm-hmm. right, and say, yep. Hey, I want to target ads to people who fit certain kinds of profiles.
Sure. You know, are you a, you know, far-leaning left person? Are you a narrow right person? I mean, you can look at that stuff and you can target people. Are your political views centrist, left, right? You know, most elections are really decided by the middle 10%. So Facebook can go in there, and even if you don't post anything yourself about politics, they can look at your friends posting, and they can figure out at about an 80 to 90% accuracy where your political leanings are.
Now, Cambridge Analytica is a political consulting firm. They work for campaigns around the world, mm-hmm. and they had made the case, in effect, that they had gotten Trump elected at some point or insinuated that. And people are saying that, a lot of people are saying that's hype, or there's varying reactions to
it's
how much
really
there is to
it. It's a really good sales pitch for the company.
Right. But is there something they could do with that data and combining it with other information out there and then reaching back into social media and targeting people? That seems more underhanded than the usual political campaign might be.
Well, what they did was pretty ingenious. I mean, this is still a new medium. People are still trying to figure out how this digital marketing works. You know, we're really looking at a medium that isn't even 10 years old. And people are really exploring how it works, what works well, what doesn't work. And the fact that this company did it so efficiently and so targeted is, it's really quite clever what they did. You have to, in a way, kind of respect just how much detail and success they had with it, even if you don't agree with it, you really should still respect just how well it's targeted. And it really sets it up for future political campaigns. I can imagine every politician with a digital strategist is following this going, now what exactly did they do, and how can we do something like that while still staying within the laws that are out there?
Steve Knoll is with us from Madison College, looking at this story about Facebook user data getting used by a political consulting group. Steve, Facebook is getting a lot of attention here. Some in Congress are wanting Mark Zuckerberg to testify there. British Parliament, and a lot of this story took place in England. That's where Cambridge Analytica is not based exactly, right, but some of their key figures are there. And a lot of criticism for Facebook now and in the past for what they do with user data. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, and again, this is still a relatively new medium, and the law is a slow-moving animal. So the big question is, if they did something wrong, what laws did they break? You know, a lot of time laws are passed in hindsight after there's an example. That's one of the big questions right now is, you know, Facebook is in the data collection business. Everybody knows that. Facebook is free. There's a saying in marketing that if something's free, you're the product. So this isn't really a surprise with anyone. I think Facebook kind of went into it in a bit of a naive way of saying, you know, we're a good company and we think people are doing good things with this. Not everybody out there is good and ethical. And it was only a matter of time before somebody did something unethical and potentially illegal. The big question is if it's illegal or not. That's what's still being sorted out.
Let's flip this around now from this high level to the person sitting at their computer or with their phone in their hand using Facebook. How, knowing what we know now and what people who follow the industry have known for some time, how should we think of our participation in Facebook?
Well, you just have to, and again, if it's free, you're the product. So anything you're doing online, you have to make the assumption that somebody is monitoring that, collecting it, looking at it with the intention of selling an ad to you. So people should be aware of that. It's in the Facebook terms of agreement. When people sign up for Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, it is in the terms that this information is being collected with the intention of putting advertisements in front of you. Of course, how many people read through the terms of agreement? They just scroll through the bottom, tick the box, and keep going. There are things, though, like a lot of these, what Disney character are you? What Star Wars villain are you type tests, quizzes that are very, very popular. These are all simple psychographic data collection programs running by companies to learn more about you. Even things like status updates, things like if you care about childhood cancer, you'll copy and paste the status for 1 hour. All that stuff is simply put out there to get people and then track them to see, hey, who's gullible, who's willing to take things at face value. Maybe we can track these people and then hit them for something potentially, you know, scamming them or even just targeting them for some specific product.
That's us contributing data to Facebook. Now we're looking at ads popping up or stories being shared. Mm-hmm. What kind of attitude should we bring to the stuff that is targeted toward us?
Well, I always say, you know, think before you share. You know, that's a big thing. Personally, when I see an ad on Facebook, my first thought is, how well did they get me? And if it isn't really targeted to me personally, I do get kind of annoyed because these companies should be able to, I'm willing to put out a certain amount of information that I'm comfortable with. So in return, I would expect that companies are offering me products that I would want. So there is kind of a little bit of a double-edged sword in that the more you put out, the more you can get back in terms of targeted information. The thing, though, that kind of bothers me about it is a lot of people don't realize that when you agree to take these quizzes or whatever, it's not just the information in the quizzes. It's also things like a list of all your friends and all the pages they like and other types of information. I don't think people really understand just how much information is being gathered just with a simple click in the span of a split second by doing these quizzes. And, of course, these quizzes are highly popular because they are fun. They're goofy and they're silly and they're cute and it gives you some fun content to share, but they really are simply data collection tools. They are just the millennium's version of a survey.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College, looking at the alleged harvesting and use of Facebook users' personal data by a political firm linked to the Trump campaign. Right now, a new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention takes a look at binge drinking in America, and the news is not great for Wisconsin. For men, binge drinking is defined as consuming at least 5 drinks in a 2-hour span. For women, that's 4 drinks. Nationwide, about 1 in 6 adults say they binge drink. Here in Wisconsin, 1 out of 4 says they do. That's the highest rate in the country. And when binging, Wisconsinites drink about 7 drinks in a 2-hour span, which is right in line with the national average for binge drinkers. Julia Sherman is the project coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Julia, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about this study, first of all, Julia. I think we all have had a sense and a knowledge that there's a binge drinking problem in Wisconsin. This seems like a really big effort to put some numbers behind what's going on with binge drinking.
Exactly. You know, binge drinking is called the hidden face of the alcohol problem, and this study lets us look at it very carefully. For the first time, we're looking at and realizing that binge drinking isn't just a college problem. It occurs across the lifespan. And while Wisconsin has a serious binge drinking problem, it does occur in every state, including states we usually don't associate with binge drinking, like Utah.
And talk about the health risks of binge drinking. How big a part of the alcohol problem is it?
It's a significant problem. And the other part of it is people are unaware. You know, alcohol use is a risk in 7 different kinds of cancer. And 70% of the population is really unaware of the fact that alcohol use is part of, is a major role in whether or not you're getting mouth cancer, throat cancer, esophageal, breast, liver, colorectal cancer. Last year, the American Society of Clinical Oncology issued a statement where they talked about alcohol use is a cancer risk that's dose-dependent. So if you want to reduce your cancer risk, drink less. But most people don't realize that. The American Heart Association does not recommend any form of alcohol use to improve your health. And now it looks, if you look back at our liver cirrhosis rates, they've been increasing over the past decade as well. But actually, more people in Wisconsin die as a result of acute accidents that occur.
And on the show, we've talked about drunk driving as one of those accidents. That's one kind. We've also talked about the risk of falls for seniors who are binge drinking. So there's risks all across the age spectrum.
Exactly. And in fact, we've been seeing the percentage of people that are dying from alcohol-related falls, and the majority of them are age 65 or older. We've been seeing that number steadily increase in recent years. But we also see alcohol poisonings. We see people that are dying from self-harm that's alcohol-related. And then there are the drownings and the homicides. There are a lot of different ways that alcohol can help you kill yourself. And so that's a problem as well. So the fact is, it makes life more dangerous, and it makes disease more likely. If we all drank just a little bit less, we'd all be a lot better off.
This study we're talking about, it's pretty new. It's kind of unprecedented in the way it tried to measure binge drinking. Do we have any kind of indication that binge drinking is getting worse? We're having more episodes of binge drinking with more alcohol consumed.
It does appear that the binge drinking rate in Wisconsin has been relatively steady. When you look at binge drinking through the sorts of measures that have been repeated over a number of years, those numbers have been pretty stagnant, but they've been high and stagnant when we really hoped we'd see them dropping. And another thing to remember is that 9 out of 10 people who are binge drinking are not alcohol dependent. So when we talk about the need for additional treatment options, that's true, but additional treatment won't get at binge drinking because those people don't need treatment.
Talking to Julia Sherman from the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the UW Law School, looking at a new study on the scope of binge drinking in Wisconsin and around the country. Julia, did anything else stand out for you in this study as far as who is drinking and how much they're drinking?
Well, I think it was some confirmation of some things we'd always known in Wisconsin, that in fact, the white population has the highest rate of binge drinking, and as you know, the rate of white folks here in Wisconsin is relatively high. The African American and Asian populations have the lowest rate of binge drinking. Native Americans, slightly less than a white population, and then below that, Hispanics. So by and large, demographically, we pretty much learned what we already knew. But what really stands out for me is the issue that it occurs all across the lifespan. We can't think of this as a young person's problem anymore. We have to watch out for ourselves and our neighbors and our habits, and especially our senior citizens and our families. We need to watch our drinking habits all through our life, because people can unintentionally slip into binge drinking, affect their health, and make their living just very dangerous.
Is there a culture around alcohol that encourages binge drinking or maybe excuses it?
I don't think it's a culture. I think it's a series of very simply, easily defined facts. For example, alcohol is very inexpensive in Wisconsin compared to other states. We haven't raised our beer tax here since 1969. And it's funny, but two of the states in the nation that had the lowest beer tax is Wisconsin, which used to be the home to Miller, and Missouri, which used to be the home to Anheuser-Busch. We have kept our historically low tax rates, even though those corporations now have their headquarters elsewhere. Our wine tax is low, and so is our distilled spirits tax. And there are a stack of studies a half mile high that show that at 1,000 different price points, increasing the cost of alcohol by increasing the alcohol tax will slightly reduce the amount of alcohol people drink. The other thing that makes a big difference here in Wisconsin is we have alcohol outlets everywhere. Think about when you're driving home. There are a lot of places that you can buy alcohol. In a lot of states, you can't buy alcohol at a gas station and the grocery store and the big box store and the drug store. There are very few places in Wisconsin where you can't find an alcohol sales. And we know that a higher rate of alcohol outlets encourages people to drink more. So one of the things communities can do, because that's under community control, one of the things communities can do to reduce their problem of binge drinking is just hold off for a while before you approve new outlets. Think about what you want your community alcohol environment to be, and then judge applications for new places that want to sell or serve alcohol. Compare what they propose to what your community wants. Not every new alcohol license should be approved, because that also contributes to binge drinking.
Those are some of the recommendations from the CDC, limiting the number of alcohol outlets in an area. They also talk about limiting days and hours when alcohol can be sold. Is that something you're hoping to do more of in Wisconsin?
Well, sadly, we've been going in the other direction here. If you will look at it, a couple years ago, the legislature expanded the hours for off-premises sales, places where you buy alcohol and then you drink it someplace else. They moved it back to 6 a.m. from 8 a.m. So now you can pick up a six-pack, cold six-pack, at a convenience store while kids are still walking to school. The other thing that we're seeing in the state is the expansion of alcohol availability through something called click and collect, where people can buy the alcohol online, and then they go and pick it up at the licensed premises. There's been a debate on that in Madison and in a lot of communities throughout the state. Some communities, like Nina, are deciding they don't want to expand the availability of alcohol that way, so they've just flat-out prohibited it. Other places, like Fond du Lac, have put a number of restrictions on it, and I believe Madison put a number of restrictions on it as well. Time will tell whether those restrictions were sufficient, but that's another way that alcohol becomes more available.
Are there other measures that you think would help? And you mentioned the taxes, limiting geographic area, limiting hours. Anything else that you'd like to see change when it comes to binge drinking here in the state?
I'd like to see a lot change when it comes to binge drinking. But I think it really comes down to is the availability and the cost. Those are the two factors that really make a huge difference. I will say that a number of communities are compiling some very interesting data used from OWI citations to determine where the place of last drink was served before someone got picked up for OWI, so we can identify those licensees that are regularly over-serving. We look for patterns. We don't look for single incidents, and it's about the location where the alcohol was consumed, not about the driver. But we've collected this data and that for years. And in the last past two or three years, We've begun to compile it, and we see patterns emerge, and that allows local authorities to work with local licensees to improve their serving patterns so that everybody's a little bit safer and healthier.
Let's talk about people at the younger end of the spectrum. Well, what do you think would help keep maybe those just out of high school, college-age kids, people in their early 20s, from starting on binge drinking?
Well, it's not so much starting on binge drinking. It's alcohol initiation overall. One of the things that communities can do that will reduce underage drinking is alcohol age compliance checks. A number of years ago, the state of Wisconsin had federal money they could distribute for this, and unfortunately that money's gone. But we know that alcohol age compliance checks are a very effective way of reducing youth access to alcohol. And no matter how much they talk about it, youth can't drink what they can't get a hold of. And alcohol age compliance checks are a great place to start. They actually don't cost the community that much. And in a number of communities, local citizens groups and the anti-drug coalition, they partner up with the local police department. And the community groups do the parts of the project that don't require a sworn officer. And the community picks up the time of the sworn officer. And in fact, through the collaboration, we can make sure that different outlets are training their staff to look for ID, examine the ID, and only sell alcohol to people that are age 21 or older.
We'll leave it there for now. Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to talk to you. Thanks again.
That's Julia Sherman, project coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We talked with her about a new CDC study about binge drinking. First, while we get ready to shed our winter coats and maybe put them back on a few more times, many birds that have migrated south for the winter are making their journey back to Wisconsin. Some of those birds travel something on the order of 600 miles crossing the Gulf of Mexico during migration times. Tom Schultz joins us. He's a former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He's been birding here in Wisconsin for over 45 years and recently returned from leading a Wisconsin Society of Ornithology birding tour in Costa Rica. He lives in Green Lake and is a professional bird artist and illustrator. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
And Tom, I understand you've watched birds and painted birds all over the world. How does Wisconsin stack up when it comes to seeing birds out in the wild?
Well, I would certainly say that some of the tropical countries have us, probably have a lead on us in some of the colorful and exotic forms, but we stand up pretty well here in the northern part of the U.S.
And to talk about the spring migration season, when does it start and when does it really wind down?
Well, I suppose technically it really starts around the end of January or certainly through the month of February, and it continues to accelerate in fits and starts, and then I would say it, depending on where you are in the state, it varies somewhat, but generally the peak is somewhere around the middle part of May, sometimes late May if you're further north in Wisconsin.
I want to give a listen to a bird I think I've seen. Correct me if I'm jumping the gun here. Here's a listen to the sandhill crane. And I do love seeing and hearing these guys. They are already making their way back in. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. Many sandhill cranes have been reported since about the middle of February, and their numbers are continuing to increase day by day. What you played there is actually a unison call where you have both a male and female sandhills calling together in kind of a syncopated fashion.
And you've been watching birds in Wisconsin for a long time. Can you talk about the numbers of sandhill cranes in the state? They've really bounced back over the, last 30, 40 years, right?
That's really true. When, I would say probably in the 1940s, there were very few sandhill cranes present in Wisconsin, but the numbers continue to increase. And right now, they're pretty much... they can pretty much be found statewide. They've been a true success story in recovery.
And before we move on from the crane family, I know there's an ongoing effort with the whooping crane to get that population up and migrating again. Is it likely that we're going to get a glimpse of one unless we actually actively try to do it?
Well, it's entirely possible. It all depends where you live in the state. There's certain parts of the state where they've been, where there have been reintroduction programs actively taking place. And if you live in that central part of the state, your chances might be pretty good. But if you live, say, in the western or far northern part of the state, perhaps in the east, your chances are probably much smaller.
Yeah, where are good places to go to check out, getting back to the Sandhills? Where are good places to go for a day of Sandhill watching?
Well, anywhere in the central wetlands. I live in Green Lake County, and the White River Marsh State Wildlife Area is fairly close by. And that's an excellent place to see sandhills, both in migration and during the breeding season. But there are lots of other counties in this area that have many, many cranes, all the way up to the northwestern part of the state where Crex Meadows is located. That would be Burnett County, but Columbia County, Winnebago County, Dodge Counties, Marquette, Juneau, and Adams Counties. Those are all excellent places for cranes.
We're talking to Tom Schultz, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, longtime bird watcher and painter and photographer here in the state, looking at the spring migration season. We heard from Chris on Facebook, who says cranes have returned to her cabin, and Pam on Facebook says she's seen cranes, robins, and juncos. She says she loves stepping outside in the morning and hearing the spring bird ruckus. So the first robins of spring have been sighted, Tom?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. They've definitely started to migrate back north. Although they're, especially in the southern half of the state, there are some robins that spend the entire winter feeding on berry crops. But for the most part, they start heading back north in the beginning part of March, and that continues to peak through April.
Who are some of the other early arrivals along with the sandhills?
Well, you'll start to see some groups or perhaps larger flocks of blackbirds starting to arrive. The red-winged blackbird is probably the most prevalent among them, but you'll also get common grackles and then a few other species mixed in, like cowbirds, and then some rusty blackbirds also, later on joined by Brewer's blackbirds. But song sparrows are starting to show up, a bird called killdeer, which is a type of shorebird, is showing up. They're found in many agricultural fields throughout the state. And then it won't be long when people may be seeing or hearing things like American woodcock and Wilson snipe also.
You mentioned red-winged blackbirds. Our team has pulled together some bird audio. Let's give a listen to the red-winged blackbird. Just hearing that makes me think of spring. When is the season, Tom, when the red-winged blackbirds get really ornery about their nests and will dive bomb us if we get too close?
Well, that's typically during the period when they have active nests going. They have eggs, or especially when they have young birds in the nest, or birds that have recently fledged. That's the time when they're most aggressive. And like you said, sometimes they will actively dive bomb if you get too close to their nest or babies.
And I wanted to ask you before we get back to some of the birds, Tom, you earlier in your career, I understand, got into painting birds. That wasn't your original plan. You're going to do water creatures. But talk about how you got into painting the birds of Wisconsin.
Well, it's kind of a long story, but it really started, my bird art career started when I was in college. I was at the UW-Madison, and I was really becoming actively interested in birds. I always liked art when I was a kid, but I never thought of it as a serious career. But during my college years, I started to do some drawing and painting of birds. And then when I graduated, I decided to continue with that effort. My big break occurred when I got my first painting accepted into the Birds and Art Show up in Wausau, Wisconsin, the annual Birds and Art exhibition. And it just so happened that the same year the National Geographic Society was looking for artists to illustrate their new field guide. This was in 1981, and I got a call from them, and I started work on that, and I've been working for them on and off ever since. We just finished work on the 7th edition of that same field guide to the Birds of North America.
And if we get that guide, what are some of your contributions in there?
Well, when I first started, it was pretty much one group. That was the gulls and terns and jaegers. But over the years, each time they do a new edition, I've been asked to do different groups. And so now I have some of my illustrations in pretty much every group, from sparrows to warblers to rails, even a few ducks and cranes and shorebirds.
You mentioned jaegers. Is it too early for them to be showing up? From past bird discussions, I'm a fan of the parasitic jaeger. I think it's a little early for those, right?
Yeah, it would be a little bit early. They're really not as strong, at least not as frequently observed in the landscape in the springtime as they are in the fall. Fall tends to be the peak of migration. We hold an annual field trip up near Superior on Wisconsin Point, and we see jaegers, multiple jaegers every single day when we're up there. But in the springtime, it's much more difficult.
Tom Schultz is with us, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He's talking with us about birds and the spring migration season, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about observing the birds around you, where to go to watch for them? Have you spotted some interesting birds as some of the recent re-arrivals lately in the spring migration season? Are you wondering when to expect a particular bird, and do you plan bird-watching trips around the state this time of year? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Tom Schultz. He's a former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Been birding in Wisconsin for over 45 years, and a painter and artist of birds as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to know about the birds in your part of the state? Maybe about drawing them to your yard or where to go out and see them in nature? What have you seen in your neck of the woods lately? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Harold is with us in Manitowoc. Harold, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing? Great program today.
Thanks. What did you want to bring up, Harold?
I would like to see a painted bunting, and I would like your guests to maybe give me a shot at times and places. I've traveled extensively in central Wisconsin, Washera County. I've seen a lot of birds there. And I'd just like to know what he has to say about that.
Well, Harold, I hate to give you disappointing news, but the painted bunting is a very difficult bird to find in Wisconsin. They occasionally show up from time to time, but they're often just one-day wonders, as they're called. They show up one day and they're gone the next. If you have your heart set on seeing painted buntings, I would probably head down to some of the southern states, Florida, Texas, and so forth. But I've only seen one in Wisconsin, and I happen to know that the person who leads the list, the bird list in Wisconsin over the years, he has never seen a painted bunting in Wisconsin. So it's a difficult bird to find here.
Harold, long odds there. I wouldn't put a lot of money on that one. But maybe a trip down south. Thanks for the call, Harold. We'll go next to Becky in Nisida. Becky, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I've already seen a group of like four or five bluebirds flying through. So that's kind of been fun.
All right, Becky, thanks. And we have the sound of an eastern bluebird. Here's a listen. All right, and I gather that's a favorite of a lot of birders. Tom, talk about the bluebirds.
Well, bluebirds are starting to arrive, especially in the southern half of the state, and they've become much more numerous in the last 20 years than they formerly were, in large part, I think, because people are putting out nest boxes specifically for them. They're actually a member of the thrush family, so they're related to robins, but they're a smaller species, and I guess many would say much more colorful. They are nice to have around, and they're not particularly shy. Sometimes people feed them mealworms and get them to come in fairly close for mealworm feeding. So it's fun to see them. I have some bluebird feeders here, and they've been actively checking out the boxes the last couple of weeks.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Elizabeth with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been going to a class called Breakfast with the Birds. It's run by Eric Volden. He's a master naturalist at Bethel Horizons in Dodgeville. And it's been really fun. It started in January and goes to May, and it's been really fun learning from him. We have breakfast, and we watch the birds inside. He's got a whole viewing area, and he teaches us about all the different kinds of birds that start arriving at different times in the spring, and he also keeps track of when their arrivals happen. So it's just been a really great, great opportunity on Saturday morning.
Elizabeth,
very relaxing.
Thanks a lot for calling, Elizabeth. And that's a great idea, Tom, for people who are, you know, like me. I can pick out, you know, a handful of different birds. Other ones kind of get lost in the shuffle for me. Tom, can you talk about taking birding classes or tours around the state?
Yeah, it's definitely a great idea to go on field trips or take classes. And there are various groups around the state of Wisconsin that you can connect up with. There are lots of local clubs. If people go on the WSO website, which is wsobirds.org, there's actually a list you can find there of the different bird clubs around the state. And if you connect with them, you might be able to get some information from the members about where classes might be held or local field trips. That's one of my jobs, fun jobs really, is to lead field trips for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. I've been doing it for over 30 years now, and we have field trips around the state, different locations, and that information can be found on the WSO website.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to Tom Schultz about a spring bird migration season. He's former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, still, as he says, leading birding tours around the site. We heard from Ed in Algoma, Tom. Ed wants to know why he's seeing so many brown pelicans. Are we seeing a lot of brown pelicans? Is that a species or just a descriptor? I don't know. Tom?
I'm guessing he's talking about the white pelican, American white pelican. The brown pelican is quite a rare species in Wisconsin. There are only a few records, but the white pelicans definitely have become more numerous in the last 20-plus years, and now they can be seen in pretty much any corner of the state. And when they come through in the spring during the migration period, sometimes you can see flocks of hundreds of them.
I want to give a listen to, this one was recommended to me, this call, a Sora Rail. Here's what it sounds like. That's a cool sound, and our executive producer, Judith Sears-Poisson, tells me that's a bird more often heard than seen. Can you tell us about the Sora Rail, Tom?
Yeah, that's true for most of the rails. They're inhabitants of marshlands, cattail marshes, and sometimes sedge meadows, and they can be very difficult to observe because they're often down in the dense vegetation, but they do have these distinctive calls that they give. I love the call of the Sora. The extended call is often called a whinny, and it does sound a little bit like the whinny of a horse. You can, with some patience, get to see them especially a little after midsummer when the young ones are out of the nest and starting to wander around, and you'll see them starting to show up on the open edges of the marsh.
Let's go to another caller now. Diane is with us in Iron County. Diane, hi.
Hi. Just the weirdest thing this winter, I live near Lake of the Falls County Park, and there's a waterfall, and there's been a male duck, mallard male duck, that made it all winter living in right below the falls. It would get really cold and almost nowhere for him to go, but he's still there, and he's made it the entire winter.
Diane, thanks for the call. So do we sometimes see ducks and other waterfowl just stick around for the whole winter?
Yes, if they can find open water and presumably find enough food, you know, to sustain them, keep their energy up through the winter, they'll stay, especially mallards. You'll see them, you know, in some of the local parks where there may be aerators. And but again, the big key would be whether they can find food. And some of these places, they get fed by people that are, they're well-meaning people, and they like to see the birds come in close. But mallards definitely are a fairly common resident of the winter.
And that reminds me, my wife and I were out walking and saw on a little bit of open water in the lake, really small waterfowl, too small to be ducks. We're not good birders. We don't know what they were. Any idea of what a smaller waterfowl might be?
What time of the year was that, Rob?
This is like 2-3 weeks ago, I'm going to say.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a little early for some of the teal to be returning, but those are the smaller. There's a blue-winged teal and a green-winged teal. They're both fairly common ducks, but they typically don't arrive in bigger numbers until sometime in April. But it's possible that some could be showing up as well. Mallards are among the larger groups of the duck family, and there may be others like hooded mergansers that are smaller than mallards, and some of the other diving ducks. But it all depends where you are, I guess, and how deep the water is. Some of the diving ducks don't especially like shallow water, but there are other birds that are considered ducks or thought of as ducks, like the American coot. And they're on a small range of the size of a duck, and they're not really members of the duck family, but they can be confused with them because they float like ducks.
I think it was probably an American coot. I think we have our winner there. Tom, real briefly, you just did this Costa Rica birding tour. What is your next tour coming up?
Well, we actually have a field trip coming up on Saturday morning, and this is primarily taking place in Columbia County. We get into Dane County somewhat. We meet at Goose Pond Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, and it'll last till roughly around noon.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob. Always happy to talk about birds.
We've been talking about birds, especially spring migratory birds. Tom Schultz was with us, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. You can still share your sightings, what is in your backyard. Tweet us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Today is the official first day of spring, but Major League Baseball's spring training has been running for a while now, as we heard in an interview over the last week or two. Sports writer Tom Hodricourt told us there's a lot of work at spring training, but also a more relaxed atmosphere than the regular season. The Milwaukee Brewers embraced that relaxed attitude this weekend when they released a video of a bunch of the team members recreating a scene from the 1993 movie The Sandlot. The movie marks its 25th anniversary next month, and it celebrates the ups and downs of low-budget kids' baseball. Here's a sample of the Milwaukee Brewers reenactment.
Holy crap, you could have been killed!
Yeah, truly, what are you doing?
You guys were leaving, so I just thought I'd hop the fence.
You were thinking, you wouldn't have thought that.
You can't go back there.
Then how do we get the ball back?
We don't. It's history. Kiss it goodbye.
Kiss it.
Shut up, Chase.
It's gone, man. It's gone.
Game's over, man. We'll just get another ball tomorrow. We'll never see it again.
Oscar Academy members can fill out their ballots right now, I think. Well, why can't they get that ball back? It's because of the Beast. In the original movie, the Beast is an ornery English Mastiff. In the Brewers version, in a surprise cameo, the Beast is Hank T. Dog, the stray dog who was adopted by the Brewers a few years back, becoming the team's unofficial mascot. Hank is a part Bichon Frise, mixed breed. He's a little less intimidating than the original Beast. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.